This week, mostly green across the financial markets, with silver, Bitcoin, and U.S. equities leading the charge. Well, welcome back, everyone. Chris Walczak here with another Muy Grande size show. Two more big guests on this April 20th episode, and it's just really great to have you back with us here. Who are the big guests this week? Well, I'm glad you asked. John Williams of ShadowStats.com, a leading online alternative economic soothsayer, sees potential for big things ahead in the precious metals and commodities. Really excited to have Eric Voorhees. This is the CEO of the Instant Bitcoin and Altcoin Exchange, Shapeshift.io. You can exchange almost any cryptocurrency with minimal information. It's just a fantastic service. He's an original Bitcoin OG, so we're just really kind of humbled to have him here on the show with us. I think you'll really enjoy this, all of my crypto fans. And we discuss the latest big $250,000 target from Tim Draper. That's right, the self-made billionaire, startup wizard, plus a crypto pioneer. He's calling for $250,000 Bitcoin by 2020. He just sees it as the leader in the space, the front runner. He expects almost every transaction in the United States to very soon be virtual in nature. People will simply no longer use cash. They will be swiping their iPhones and Androids with their Bitcoin QR code. So we will see. 5 years seems very ambitious. He's been right on almost all of his forecasts so far. And I'd like to talk to everybody today about a fascinating individual online. This is for anyone who has ever had an addiction, a food addiction, a shopping addiction. Maybe it's gambling. Maybe it's trading. Maybe it's just, I don't know, the typical traditional addictions that we all talk about. I'm a 19-year teetotaler. Most people, if they're honest, would raise their hand and admit at some time or another, they had at least a short-term addiction that maybe led to overeating, shopping too much, running up credit cards. It's just a natural state of this world we're living in. Well, I have found someone who's dedicated his life to helping all of us with these issues. He has gotten down to the heart of addiction better than any other doctor. He's an MD in the area, world renowned. He actually escaped the Holocaust in Hungary. His mother had to hand him to a stranger at one point. Just a harrowing story. This individual has worked with more people and could easily retire at 75 years old. He looks 20 years younger than he is, probably because he dedicates all of his time to helping people with really serious addictions to recover their lives. Why is this so important? Well, I think this is going to become a huge epidemic if it isn't already in the United States. We're losing as many as 3,600 people per year. That's the World Trade Center disaster each year to the opioid epidemic that's sweeping this country. And folks, this, I believe, is about to get out of control. If you're in criminal justice, or you know anyone who is, or you're, I don't know, you're at your local coffee shop, talk to a police officer, talk to someone, and just ask them, maybe an ambulance driver or an ER worker. What you'll find is this epidemic is really getting out of control. Now, it all started with the fact that they cracked down on oxys and other painkillers, right? And so people turn to the bad stuff, which we won't mention here. And it's just taken off since fentanyl, which is, you know, 10 to 20 times more potent than morphine. It's just gotten worse. Those OD cases are nothing compared to what's coming. Carfentanil. This is elephant tranquilizer. They've just found it by the ton in Canada, and it's starting to sweep across the United States. Okay, I don't want to turn this into an intervention show, but I wanted to kind of lay the groundwork as to why this is so important, because all of us know someone at one time or another, or have themselves faced addiction. What Dr. Gabor Maté has found is that 100% of people with serious life-threatening addiction addictions were either abused, abandoned, or had serious trauma as very young people. You know, that neuroplasticity was damaged. The brain has, the pathways were injured, and that's the bad news. The good news is that it can be healed. You can reunite yourself with that person that was injured. All right, so I don't want to get too in-depth here. He does a much better job than I ever could trying to convey these very delicate and remarkably profound points. But I think the key takeaway is that we here in America, we're under such stress. It's go, go, go. From the minute you're born, you hit the ground running, right? And you never have a chance to catch your breath. The ego is almost a self-preservation mechanism that helps us to survive. But particularly in the United States, we just push and push and push so hard. I want to recommend everyone get a hold of these free videos at Dr. Gabor Mati. You can find it online. He's written some fantastic books as well, including Hold On to Your Children. And he helps, I think, everyone involved to heal that inner person, okay, that may have been damaged or just needs to be reconnected to. And as well, the importance of nurturing relationships, whether it be with your kids or your family or your friends. And I've reached out to him, so we hope to have him on the show. We'd like for you to call in on our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 514049. You can call in 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, record your message, and we'll get to them as soon as we can. Please jot it down on a Post-it pad or plug it right into your phone. And I'm still offering one free S9 Antminer. That's the big 13.5 terahash. If you'd like it brand new in the box, just sign up for a 10-year subscription. You get the Alpha Stocks newsletter for 10 years for free. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the silver market this week with a small short squeeze on news that the CRB Commodities Index recorded a 2-year high. The world's best inflation safe haven, though, finished near the break-even, off less than $10 at 0.5% at $13.37. That's gold. Holding firmly, though, above support still. Meanwhile, silver did pick up 50 cents, 3%, ending at 1716, while the XAU Precious Metal Shares Index gained over a dollar, finishing at 85.12. Black gold. Crude oil picked up a dollar, up 1.5%, just shy of 69, a new multi-year record high and well above consolidation support. But the big show stopper again, the Bitcoin ETF. Up $1.30 at $14.85. That's about 10% for the week on the heels of last week's 30%. The top story moving the markets included slightly improved geopolitical outlook between the U.S. and North Korea on news that the president said he hoped the summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un would be successful. In addition, many question marks remain unresolved surrounding the proposed trade barriers and tariffs in the trade war between China and the U.S. Turning to the domestic economy, one key Fed governor this week noted that the Federal Reserve would continue to raise rates 2 more times this year. And according to CME Group's data right here, the current Fed funds futures indicate virtually zero odds of a rate hike at the next FOMC meeting slated for next month, while the June meeting shows about 100% chance, nearly, of a quarter point rate hike to 200 basis points. And another quarter point rate hike in September looks highly probable, about 76%. Precious metals and Bitcoin bottom line. Well, investors just couldn't get enough of the CRB commodities for the second week running. And the U.S. dollar, although it bumped up just a little this week, is still on the cusp of what might be a big breakdown if this consolidation falls apart as it looks like it may. We could decline to at least the 2013 lows as cryptos continue, I think, to jeopardize dollar hegemony and issues, of course, on trade barriers. And as far as the precious metals go, although we had maybe what you might call a minor pause this week, we still appear very capable of blasting to $1,500, $1,600 gold and 20 plus silver in the coming weeks and months ahead. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies persisted over the New York Stock Exchange on news of easing tensions between the West and BRICS nations. Plus, investors are adjusting to the fact that the Fed funds futures indicate two more point rate hikes, supported by the positive summit between Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and the U.S. President. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones added 103, up 1.8% of 24,462. The S&P 500 added 14, about 0.5%, closing at 2670, while the Nasdaq added nearly 3%, up 4 points at 7115. Meanwhile, U.S. shares in the news included GE, General Electric, which was added to the 85% of S&P 500 companies, topping earnings estimates so far this season, up about 4%, after topping Wall Street earnings estimates. Baker Hughes, BHGE, was up about 1% after it also topped earnings estimates. Honeywell added 1.5% on better-than-expected first-quarter results. Twitter picked up over 1% on news that MKM Partners had increased its rating to a buy from neutral status. Software PVTL added about 5%. On its initial public offering, which started at $15 a share. One of the big reports next week will be Alphabet Inc. reporting on Monday. U.S. shares, bottom line. Well, it appears that the current rally lost some steam this week, and our 7-indicator greed to fear index pendulum rebounded from the extremely fear level to the more positive fearful level. I think that means some of the momentum has left this market. I wouldn't be surprised at all for us to see a retest of the recent lows in the coming weeks. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. John Williams, head of ShadowStats.com, an alternative economic resource. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
How's the weather in that part of California today?
Well, it's sunny up in the San Francisco area. Been having some storms recently, but it's a nice day today, and presumably that weather's going to be moving to the east.
That wasn't really a topic for today's discussion, but from what I'm reading through several sources, we're hearing that San Francisco might be peaking in its housing boom there, the echo bubble. Any quick comments there?
I think you're seeing that happening in a number of areas. The real estate market hasn't been as strong as it's been estimated. And if you look at the aggregate data, if you look at the existing home sales, the new home sales, housing starts, construction spending. You know, there's been some upward movement. If you smooth it out over 6 months, you're seeing basically a low level of stagnation. When I say low level, this is in contrast to where you were before the Great Recession. Generally, you're down, depending on the series, anywhere from 20 to 40%. Below the pre-recession peak, which is not exactly a fully recovered economy. In fact, the way the numbers generally are defined, if you look at the business cycle, a recession is when the economy starts to turn down from what then becomes a pre-recession peak and falls till it hits a bottom and then starts to rise. The bottom is the trough. And then as it starts to rise, that's referred to as a recovery. But you really don't get into economic expansion, at least as economic expansion has been traditionally defined, until you recover above the pre-recession peak. So what you're seeing in the housing market is indeed there's been some recovery, but we haven't seen an expansion there in well over a decade. And you see it in other series such as the manufacturing sector. There you have now 123 months, a little over 10 years of non-economic expansion. And what's interesting with that is that it's the manufacturing series is part of industrial production. It has a 100-year history behind it, and in the 100-year history of the series, you've never seen such a protracted period of non-economic expansion. This is going back to 1918, post-World War I. Now, the production headline production series has recovered, and that is due to an expanding mining sector, particularly oil and gas drilling and and extraction. But even there, with all the boom that's being reported in that area, industrial production is it's only 1% or so above its pre-recession peak. And if you follow the industrial production, it troughed and then it actually recovered and hit its prior peak at the end of 2014. You had a recovery of a couple of months, or an expansion of a couple of months, expansion of a full quarter, and then it turned down again. In the benchmark revisions that we saw last month, that recovery in 2000, that brief recovery expansion remained intact. But what disappeared was the most recent numbers of industrial production had, after they'd fallen off there, had actually regained the 2014 level. That disappeared. That sank down. So that in that benchmark revision, you lost the recovery from what probably was a double dip recession, as they would formally look at it, but it was never defined as such. You've never had a protracted series of annual declines in industrial production and not been in formal recession except this period after 2014. Nonetheless, as it stands now and the revisions that were published this last week, production again has regained its level of at the end of 2014. But again, you're not seeing anything close to what's reported with the headline GDP, which I think is a very heavily gimmicked number. Right there, the GDP is up over 15% from its pre-recession peak, but I can't find a quality series that reflects anything close to that. Again, industrial production is, you know, maybe 1% or two. Manufacturing is down 5.4% from its pre-recession peak. All the housing numbers are down 10 to 20% from their peak. If you look at retail sales, which had a bad quarter, just contracted year-to-year after inflation, quarter-to-quarter after inflation. That series is overstated because when you look at an inflation-adjusted number, what's key there is what kind of an inflation rate you use. The reason you use an inflation rate, if you look at your retail sales before adjusting for inflation, the nominal term, as they call it, let's say that's up 5%. But if inflation were up 5%, then what that means is that all your sales gain was in inflation. You're not moving a higher volume of goods. So if you look at it net of inflation, you get an idea of the physical movement of goods if you're selling more goods. The way the government reports inflation, they understate inflation. They understate consumer inflation. And if you use too low a rate of inflation as they use here, that tends to overstate the real growth, the inflation-adjusted growth. But even so, you're not looking, you're maybe up 5 to 7% from pre-recession peak. You're not up 15%. I mean, that's the GDP, that's just nonsense. Adding to the good news, you have a widening trade deficit. That generally gets subtracted from GDP activity. So with everything that's happening here, even though the GDP growth is overstated, you're likely going to see a pretty good slowing in the growth rate for the first quarter of this year. That'll be announced next week. I think it could even be a contraction. Part of that's due to storm distortions that boosted fourth quarter activity. But when you get all the benchmark revisions in place, I think you're going to see that the first quarter GDP actually did contract and that we're probably in a new recession.
Let's shift over to the commodities sector. This has been uneventful, unfortunately, for many years amid the backdrop of an unfavorable global economic situation where essentially paper assets, let's just say in vogue, and hard assets lost the attention of the deep pockets and most investors. Well, that appears to be changing rapidly. We look at the commodities sector, the CRB is perking up. West Texas leading the charge, approaching $70 and probably much higher. We also see gold near multi-year highs, the XAU showing signs of life, and even silver topping 17 recently. We have a number we haven't seen in a long time.
Commodities do tend to move. Certain commodities, such as oil, will tend to move with economic activity. but that's also a commodity because of how it's produced globally that's very sensitive to the value of the dollar. And what you've been seeing there is that the Fed has artificially propped the dollar in recent years. That's beginning to fall apart, and as the dollar weakens, you see stronger oil prices. That is a there's an inverse relationship there that's a long range correlation of about 80%. So generally, as the dollar weakens, oil in particular rises, and oil is and its derivative products are primary generators of our domestic inflation. So that as the dollar weakens and the oil prices rise, you should start to see some pickup in our headline inflation. And my contention is you're going to see got good risk of a dollar panic here as the Fed continues to run into trouble. They still haven't been able to bring the system under adequate control following the near banking collapse in 2028. And that is, as the economy weakens here, I think we're going to move back towards the quantitative easing, and that in turn will clobber the dollar, spike commodity prices, such as oil, that move contrary to the dollar, and with domestic inflation on the rise, be very bullish for the precious metals, gold and silver, which are your best hedges long-term for preserving the purchasing power of your wealth and assets. So, yeah, I see generally a market here that's going to become very bullish for gold and silver, but it's in the context of bad news of higher inflation for the people in the United States.
The threat of a trade war with China, a lot of saber rattling, the administration very upset with them, and then suddenly we find out that most of those trade tariffs were really smoke and mirrors is really what it amounted to. I mean, obviously China, our number one trading partner, but we don't want to do too much to upset the apple cart. Give us an idea of how these tariffs might impact, especially the domestic economy.
Anything that will raise the cost of the imports will tend to be inflationary. But you have a circumstance where indeed there's a lot of smoke and mirrors and huffing and puffing here. Trade deficit is a very serious problem. We've got a good shot here in the next week of seeing the worst quarterly trade deficit net of inflation that's ever been seen. Generally, it's bad news for the dollar. It's bad news for the economy. It reflects a lot of economic loss of jobs offshore, production offshore, wealth offshore. It's one reason that the electorate was disgruntled at the time of the last presidential election and helped President Trump get elected. I think he's indeed looking at addressing that trade area. We've had terrible trade deals, and people have had all sorts of motives for putting them in place. Whether they're going to be meaningfully addressed remains to be seen. I don't think anyone's going to collapse the global economy over it. I think that what's going back and forth is largely negotiation. You'll get some deals that'll improve the circumstance a little bit to the extent there's tariffs. Again, that adds to inflation, but consider, this is just something that doesn't really have a happy solution for everyone as to how you look at it, but one reason that we have this problem is that the cost of producing goods and doing business in the United States is so expensive. I mean, if you look at putting aside for a moment just our cost of labor, all the benefits, all the safety features that have to be in production, all the product liability issues that arise for people who manufacture goods here, the insurance costs, benefits costs, the health costs, they're extremely high. They're beneficial for the, but the problem is your products lose their competitiveness in the world markets. I'll give you an example. I used to have a company that manufactured abrasive wheels in Michigan. We had a product liability issue there where somebody got injured with a grinding wheel that they claimed we had made. They couldn't show that it was made by us. The insurance company handled the case, and I was a little naive at the time, but they settled it. They gave a fellow $20,000 for having lost his salt. He dropped the product. He couldn't show that it was our product. Nonetheless, they settled. But then they canceled our insurance. The cost of replacing that insurance took it from something like 0.07 of a percent of our sales to 7% of our sales. I mean, it put us out of business. It's very difficult to compete manufacturing in the U.S. environment against the rest of the world where you have such low labor costs, low cost in terms of the benefits for the workers, a lot of protection against the liability suits in the United States. Is if you want to get a product made in the United States on a competitive basis with, let's say, an Asian country, which doesn't have all the environmental standards, work standards, and such that we have, one way of trying to put things on a parallel basis is with a tariff. The point there is, say, hey, look, we've decided this is the way we want our world to be. We want workers to be treated in a good manner. We want products to be safe and for companies to take liability for things that they make mistakes on. And if you want to change your environment so that you're on parallel with us, then the tariff's not needed. But as long as we're competing in this environment, we need a tariff. There's an inequality there in the global system where the decisions that have been made by the U.S. government, legislative bodies and courts and such, have said this is what's correct, this is what we need, but it becomes uncompetitive when you try to trade in the rest of the world. So how do you balance that out? And that's, again, at this point in time, it would be tariffs.
The Federal Reserve meeting comments late last Wednesday seemed quite hawkish relative to earlier comments. I mean, there's concern over the growth that you alluded to and higher prices, i.e. inflation. Obviously, we're going to have much higher rates. This will have a detrimental impact on many areas of the economy, especially, of course, housing. You have a huge component of the economic recovery clearly in the housing sector, and the Fed funds futures now are alluding to a couple more rate hikes at least. This should put rates, it looks like, in the neighborhood of 3.75% and higher in the next year or so. Give us your idea on just how this might impact the markets as well as the economy, please.
The higher rates, indeed, are not good for the housing market. As I mentioned earlier, the housing market still hasn't recovered. The banking system hasn't recovered. The Fed has never been able to work out its system since it bailed out the banks and literally bailed out the system, preventing an economic collapse. Although we did have something pretty close to an economic collapse, it was not quite as bad as it could have been. They guaranteed all deposits. They bailed out whatever had to be bailed out. They bailed out General Motors. The Fed purchased AIG, which is the world's largest insurance company, that was providing insurance on these bad mortgage-backed securities that were bringing the banking system down. They flooded the system with liquidity, but they wouldn't let the banks lend it out into the economy, which might have helped the economy. They deposit the cash you're getting from the Fed back with the Fed, and the Fed paid the bank's interest. It's never been stabilized. They haven't worked it out, and that's still a problem around the world. And one thing that we saw in the recession that we had and the economic weakness, stagnation that I contend we have now, they've never been able to bring the system under control. They sacrificed economic growth to preserve the banking system. They probably should have scrapped the banking system and restructured that, and you might have had a basis for positive growth going forward. But until this all works out, and I think it doesn't work out with without a major crash in the system, you're not going to get normal economic growth as people are used to it.
Be remiss if I didn't mention U.S. equities. Obviously, volatility has increased markedly. We've seen the VIX and the VIX derivative surprisingly high levels, which has been extremely detrimental to the short volatility trade, which was really the go-to money maker for many years. Well, that backfired in a huge way, blowing up several funds and ETFs in the process. It all seemed to begin with that U.K. construction firm, which imploded and was the number one short company all throughout Europe. They've proven now, the hedge funds and the institutions recognize that even the powers that be knew that it was doomed. Do you believe that we've seen the peak?
Oh, that's tough to, well overvalued and don't see it having a happy ending. I think what the proximal trigger will be, a misstep by the Fed trying to prop up the banking system further as the economy weakens. What they have to watch out for, and you're beginning to see it, and it's also affecting the pricing of oil and gold, is weakness in the dollar. If you get a massive sell-off in the dollar, and I think that'll be the proximal trigger, that'll also reflect a flight of foreign capital from the U.S. equity markets as well as the credit markets, which would tend to push rates higher. But as the capital comes out of the stock market, that'll be reflected in heavy selling. That's what gave us a crash in 1987. That was a misstep. We had a very weak dollar at the time. We'd been propping it up. Here the Fed's been taking actions to prop it up as well, at least in jawboning interest rates. Coming into that weekend before the crash in 87, James Baker's and Treasury Secretary made a comment to the effect that the U.S. is no longer going to support the dollar against the Deutsche Mark. I'd been in trading currencies for a while and knew that was going to give you a massive sell-off in the dollar, which happened. And with that, the capital also fled from the stock market. And I think that's a type of circumstance you're going to see here. You have a lot of foreign capital in the markets here. As that leaves the U.S., there's enough of it to be the balance between holding the market where it is and a plunge. And I think this is going to end in some kind of a selling panic, both of the dollar and of the U.S. stocks. And the flight generally would be to the hard assets such as gold.
Now there is an alternative for the BRICS nations in particular. China launches what some folks are referring to as the death knell for the petrol arrangement. Gold-backed yuan oil contract trading heavily and with the full support of the PBOC. So give us your idea on the significance of this new exchange, whether or not this will have a major impact or if you see it as merely an anomaly.
Well, it certainly could have the, it certainly can have major impact. I mean, the yuan is, now a reserve currency, but its, relative volume in the markets is still small. That can change rapidly, but I'd watch, I mean, if you see the volume of it growing in the markets, then what you're looking at there would be a major, major threat to the dollar. Long term, that may be a case here, but I think we're going to have the panic, here triggered for more standard things before that comes into play.
And lastly, really should mention the potential impact of the crypto revolution on global currencies. I mean, obviously right now, relative to the multi-trillion dollar daily currency markets, and then of course maybe, you know, we're looking at hundreds of trillions if you add the currency, stock, and bond markets together. Are you a proponent or at least a believer that this revolution, Bitcoin and others, will pose a threat to the fiat money system? People will, within 5 years or less, they'll be looking for cryptocurrencies instead.
I'd be surprised if you see that in that time frame. I mean, down the road, there are any number of things that are going to happen, and I can't tell you that I can give you a really meaningful prediction. At this point in time, I would be very cautious there. I view the cryptocurrencies as like playing at a casino. You want to put some money in it, that's fine, but don't bet more than you can afford to lose. Frankly, I prefer physical gold. It has a traditional value there that's been established over thousands of years, and it's not subject to destruction by an electromagnetic pulse.
So you're sticking with your well-established thesis that we will see maybe Venezuela-style inflation that takes a little more than a year or so to unfold. I mean, obviously, that country has been, and in Argentina, their neighbor, have been plagued with these inflationary bouts now for decades. It just seems to be a reoccurring theme. We haven't seen anything like that in 150 years. Could that be the event that catches our policymakers off guard? And how would you see that unfold in the next few years if it were to happen?
Again, you're looking at something there that's tied to the dollar. The rest of the world decides it doesn't want to have its money in the dollar, which could happen with a misstep by the Fed. And the Fed has made missteps in the past. And things are not in balance. They don't know how to get things into balance now, so anything they try may backfire. The dollar would be the proximal trigger there again. Flight from the dollar, you'd see a big spike in oil prices, domestic inflation. If you look at the headline inflation of the last couple of years, it's been basically a matter of gasoline prices. It'll go far beyond that. But as the dollar weakens, people don't want to hold the dollar. You'll see eventually a very massive spike in inflation here. It can develop quickly. The government itself is long-term bankrupt. I mean, there's no way they can honor their long-range obligations here. That now, in terms of net present value of what they should have in cash today to cover everything they've said they're going to pay out to people in the way of Social Security and Medicare, so it's over $100 trillion. That's five times the size of our economy. It's 50% larger than the global economy. It just can't possibly be covered. So one of two things have to happen. Either they have to, and I'm talking now the U.S. government, has to take action to bring the system into solvent balance, or you're going to end up with what Alan Greenspan had suggested at the time of the downgrading U.S. debt a couple of years ago. He said, well, there's no risk of U.S. defaulting on its debt here because all its debt is in dollars, and we print dollars, and we can print as many dollars as we need to. Well, that's inflation. That's the way the world ends here, unless the politicians in Washington can find a way of bringing this under control. And you look at what's happened there the last couple of years, and even in the last couple of months, there's no indication there that there's anyone looking to seriously restore long-range solvency for the U.S. government. So ultimately, you know, you're going to end up with a worthless dollar. That's another word for inflation. Gold and silver are your primary hedges against that. They'll preserve the purchasing power of your assets over time.
Don't you suspect that they will just have a Monday morning revaluation? Suddenly find out that if you had $10,000 in the savings account or banking account, they're going to lop off a digit and you have $1,000.
They can do that, but it doesn't just a matter of redenominating the way you have prices. It doesn't really, by the time you're doing that, you've already lost the purchasing power. Let me put it this way. You had $100 back in 1900 before the Fed was founded. If you bought $100 in gold, you'd still have your $100. If you just left your money in dollars and didn't invest it otherwise, get interest on it, which in theory would tend to cover inflation, you'd be looking at something like 20 cents left on your $100 today. That's how much inflation we've had in the last 120 years. And it's not much different if you look at it the last 100 years. Most of it's happened since the founding of the Fed, but the greatest part happened after Roosevelt abandoned the domestic gold standard back in the 30s. The reason he did that was he needed more money to try and pull the economy out of the Great Depression. But in doing that, he also created a lot of inflation. And so we've got a fiat currency doomed to inflation with it over time. It's just a matter of how quick. We've been buying time with the dollar here. I watch the dollar as that goes in the global markets. You'll also see its purchasing power sink very rapidly here, meaning higher inflation.
We appreciate your thoughts, and we'd like for you to tell people more about the ShadowStats website and all the great services you're providing, please.
So I have a website, shadowstats.com. I provide a weekly newsletter. It's available to subscribers. They can download it from the site. But there's also a lot of information on the site that gives you background on a great deal of what we've talked about here today. That's free to anyone who wants to look at the site. You'll see articles over on the right-hand side. Left-hand side, you see the headlines from recent newsletters back several months. Those are all open to the public. We're always happy to have new subscribers. It's $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. If you've got any questions, you can find a way of contacting me on the website. Happy to communicate with you.
John Williams, thanks so much for making time for us today. Talk soon.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, we're so glad you're back with us at GoldSeek.com Radio. We have a very special guest today, Eric Voorhees. He's an American startup founder and CEO of the instant Bitcoin and altcoin exchange, Shapeshift.io, on his debut appearance. Welcome, Eric Voorhees.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's begin the discussion with Shapeshift.io. This is a unique online service for the exchange of virtually any coin, with one of the best aspects that it requires minimal information from users, so you don't have that invasive prying of personal information. In a nutshell, it allows you to exchange, let's say, Litecoin for Bitcoin or Ethereum for Litecoin with minimal expense and excellent customer service. I've used it without any incident. Tell us more about this groundbreaking service.
Yeah, so Shapeshift is really a fast and easy way to convert one kind of digital asset, like Bitcoin, into another kind, like Litecoin. Some ways you can think of us as an exchange, but we are fairly different than a normal exchange, so we don't have user accounts, as you mentioned. We don't hold customer funds, which is done both for our own protection and for the customers. And also, we are not matching buyers and sellers. Like a traditional exchange, we are essentially the seller. So you can think of us sort of as a retail store that is selling digital assets to our customers, who are the buyers.
Shapeshift is an important component of this nascent blockchain space. What was your genesis of the idea? What inspired you?
Depends on the time frame you're talking about. So the initial idea for Shapeshift was early 2014. We got the prototype built, and the first customer transaction was at the end of July in 2014. And I funded it all myself up through sort of early 2015. Then we did a seed round with Roger Ver and Digital Currency Group and a number of other crypto angels. We did a Series A that culminated in March of 2017, last year, where we raised over $10 million. So that's been sort of the funding process so far, but ever since last summer, we've been profitable, so maybe we won't need to raise further money.
Clearly, the global financial arena is much better off thanks to this novel online application.
Very kind of you.
I mean, it's a groundbreaking service for the global community. Moving on, let's shift the discussion to one of your recent projects. This is Salt. This allows Bitcoin holders to borrow against their coins with minimal margin call risk, a very unique algorithm there that slices away instead of one big lump margin call. And it also postpones excessive capital gains related events. Please tell us more.
In Salt's case, what they do is they allow people to take out fiat loans against their crypto collateral. So if you have $100,000 of Bitcoin and you want to buy a car, for example, currently without Salt, you would need to sell some of your crypto to buy the car. That's no fun for two reasons. One is, if you're holding the crypto, you probably think it's going to be worth more in the future, and that's why you have it in the first place. So selling it is not what you want to do from an economic perspective. And two, when you sell it some, you now have a tax event. And so any capital gains on that crypto becomes a taxable thing in your year's tax returns, which sucks, at least if you're an American. So with Salt, you could instead take out a loan for the car amount, and you would give Salt some of your Bitcoin as collateral against that loan. And as long as you pay back the loan over the terms of the loan, then you get all the Bitcoin back that you gave them. Now, there are some caveats to that. If the market starts falling apart and Bitcoin is collapsing in price, there can be margin calls, and or you can put in, you know, partial payments to help reduce the imbalance. So there are things that you can do, but ultimately, as long as the price of the crypto doesn't crash, you can pay off the loan and end up with the same amount of Bitcoin that you started with and not have the taxable event that you wanted to avoid.
You know, I think the two key bullet takeaway points there, Salt really helps you avoid frightening margin calls, and it lessens capital gains related issues. Moving on, you've been very active in many areas. Please direct the conversation to your latest projects.
Well, since 2011, my hobby, passion, and career has really been exclusively Bitcoin. I fell down the rabbit hole, as they say, and I've really just done nothing other than I've been involved in a number of projects. First, BitInstant back in early 2012, which was a way to move fiat money into the exchange back then, which was Mt. Gox, faster than a bank wire. The world's first angel, you know, invested in a crypto company. Also in 2012, I started Satoshi Dice, which was a Bitcoin casino, the largest in the world at that time. Started as a side project that just got totally out of control and became quite a big phenomenon. I had left BitInstant and I co-founded a company called Coinapult, which is a wallet provider down in Panama. I was there only for a year and left that, and then started Shapeshift shortly thereafter. And then I've been an investor in a number of different crypto startups, probably 10 or 12 at this point.
You know, I like that you referred to Bitcoin as an asset, not just a cryptocurrency per se. I agree, it's inaccurate to call it a currency in the traditional sense of the term. And moving on, you know, the consensus aspects of the crypto movement are essential. While Bitcoin is proof of work, you know, designated proof of stake is also gaining traction that doesn't involve the more energy-intensive mining. Dan Larimer has been essential to this area, developer of Steemit, BitShares, and now the EOS projects. Do you have any preferences for proof of work or proof of stake?
The thing that I've always found was most exciting about crypto, which is what got me into it in the first place, was its ability to become an alternative to fiat. I think the world hadn't really had a good alternative. I mean, it's always had gold, which is great for some things, but gold is really hard to send over the internet for normal modern commerce. And companies like eGold that had tried to build a digital system of gold that was backed by real gold, single companies like that will get shut down by the government if they get too big. Crypto was really the first global means of payment and money that didn't have any central point of failure, and thus could not be shut down, and thus over time people would find it increasingly useful as a way to move value. So I've always been most excited just by the fact that given enough time, Bitcoin or some other crypto, I don't really care which one, will displace fiat, hopefully entirely.
Exactly. You know, you may have seen Tim Draper's latest announcement this week, his prediction that Bitcoin will top 250,000 in less than 4 years. He notes that in about 5 years, cryptos will replace fiat money altogether, and that seems a bit ambitious, although very interesting. Are you concerned that regulations, though, might stifle this lofty forecast, such as the recent legislation from the Prime Minister of India?
So yeah, that rumor wasn't totally true. So often the articles that write about these news events, they are not diligent in how they do their research, and so a bunch of rumors get blown out of proportion. In India, I think the actual rule was that banks and financial institutions are not permitted to trade crypto or buy or sell it with customers. So definitely not good for crypto there, but it is not illegal for an Indian to own Bitcoin or to have a wallet.
Okay. Well, the big need for crypto is clearly in third world nations where financial services can be very difficult to come by. You know, 2 to 3 billion people are reportedly unbanked. They have little or no access to checking, savings accounts, and the traditional mortgage and related small business financing. You've been a pioneer in this area, an OG, if you will. Would you like to talk to the importance of this revolution to developing nations?
Yeah, well, clearly one of the great things about the internet itself and also why it took off in the way it did was because it was borderless. It allowed any two people to move information between each other or to broadcast information to many without respect to the invisible lines that politicians like to draw on maps. And it really connected the world in a very important way. And that's been great for information, but value, up until crypto happened, still had borders. All banking networks and payment systems have territorial restrictions. Sometimes they don't work in certain places. Sometimes they're not authorized to transfer in certain places. And it always is about the country and the origin and all that kind of stuff that the internet itself has no conception of. So what Bitcoin and other cryptos allow is for money to move in a borderless fashion instantly at very little cost, in the same way that the internet allowed information to move in a borderless way at very little cost. And I think you're right that one of the largest groups of people that will benefit from this technology will be people in the third world that are currently unbanked that will likely leapfrog banking entirely, move into a digital payment, digital money form, just as they did with phones, where they went from not having any phone infrastructure to leapfrogging directly to cell phones without build out of landlines. I think a similar thing will happen with them in banks, and that'll be really exciting to watch.
Well, you know, Mike Novogratz, the legendary hedge fund manager and now big crypto pioneer, he anticipated the bubble last year ahead of the big run-up, noting that virtually every interesting and groundbreaking disruptive technology starts with a bubble. And it's important because it leads to the Googles and the Amazons.
Well, the thing about markets is that there usually isn't one cause for things. In Bitcoin, you know, 2017 was an amazing year. Bitcoin was one of the slowest growing of all compared to some of the others, just because they were starting from a smaller base. But really, it's a confluence of things. Certainly more of the financial institutions are starting to get involved, and not yet banks really, but you know, hedge funds and family offices that are willing to experiment with more cutting edge stuff. Some of them are certainly getting into cryptos at this point as an asset class. And a lot of normal people are just increasingly moving into the technology. A lot of them, unfortunately, are only interested or intrigued by the price rising. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy when the price has been going up steadily for a while. It just builds into a bubble. But some portion of those people who cared about price at the start end up learning about what this technology is and why it's important, and they end up starting companies and building the technology out further. So these bubbles are very good for bringing in people and also for getting people interested in it. And then, you know, there'll be a cooling off period of months or years, and the cycle seems to repeat. I've been through four of these at this point, and I'm sure there'll be more of these bubbles. You know, they'll keep happening as during the ascent of crypto to become the dominant financial structure of the planet. I think part of Bitcoin being a free market money implies that it's now a market, and there are going to be different types of assets, some that compete directly with Bitcoin, some that are complementary, some that are a little of both, and it's just a whole new world of experimentation. So while Bitcoin was the first and remains the most important crypto asset and the most secure and trusted blockchain to date, there are many others. You know, most of the crypto projects out there are flat out scams, and some of them might be well-intentioned but aren't going to end up doing anything useful. But some minority of them are going to change the world, Bitcoin and Ethereum being the two most likely to fall into that category at this point. But I think it's great that people are experimenting with this stuff, and you know, no one knows what the right structure of crypto assets will be, so thank goodness people can experiment. And the rate of innovation that's happening in crypto, you compare that to what banks have done, or I should say haven't done, over the last 100 years. And it shouldn't be a too much of a leap of faith to realize that banks will probably be consumed or out-innovated by this technology.
Great points. You know, Tim Draper speaks to this, that the two key areas that need to be disrupted are healthcare and government, where he sees big opportunities to improve costs, lower expenses, and enhance productivity. He's investing heavily there. Looking forward, what are your thoughts on the future of the crypto world? Bitcoin has now lost some dominance. We're in the 30 to 40% area as Ethereum and competing tokens fill the void with novel but important new services and robust applications. What do you see on the horizon?
I try to not make too many specific predictions in crypto because it's so dynamic, and you know, even being as much of an insider as one can be, I don't really know where it's all going even 2 or 3 years from now. But what is clear to me is that the world now has natively digital value that can move anywhere instantly at near zero cost between any two people, regardless of borders. And that is such a profound change that it is impossible for the technology to exist and not change the world in a fundamental way. So I don't know exactly how it'll change it. I think government fiat currencies will fall apart over the next 20 years. An entirely new financial system and structure will be rebuilt upon more honest and transparent and market-based forms of money. I just want to watch that play out and help make it happen. And that's what I've been doing since 2011 and what I will continue to do.
Well, you certainly have. You know, the topics of value proposition and use case scenarios remain hotly debated in the crypto environment. Do you see any challenges and hurdles on the horizon?
The ultimate killer use cases of crypto probably are not out yet, other than just the best way to pay someone on the other side of the world. I mean, that's a pretty cool use case. People who are familiar with crypto spend 30 seconds sending money to someone 2,000 miles away instead of taking 2 hours to go down to the bank and spend a bunch of money and wait a week for it to happen. see immediately why this stuff is useful, and it's pretty obvious. But yeah, I mean, beyond that, sort of the world is still experimenting with it all, and a lot of different activities and business models will be tried and failed over the coming years.
You know, instead of having the third party between participants, we have a trustless exchange system that liberates people from excessive fees and unwanted interference. It's a truly free, independent marketplace for the first time in history. So, Eric, thanks for educating us today on this groundbreaking development and your key contributions to the world of cryptocurrencies. Where would you direct the listeners to point their web browsers?
I would direct them to coincap.io if they're interested in this stuff. Coincap.io is a list of all the different digital assets out there, real-time price of all of them ranked by market cap. So it's just a good way to keep tabs on the industry and to see the different assets rising and falling over time. And also, for those who are somewhat new to this, there's a lot of talk about investing in crypto and all that. I advise people to not think of this as an investment primarily. First and foremost, you should think of this as an important technology and try to understand it. Try to use it. Learn how it works. Learn how to send funds from one area to another. Learn the basic structure and model and terminology of this technology. Once you understand it and learn it, then you can decide if you think it's a good investment or not. But to just buy it because the price has gone up in the past is really the worst reason to do anything. Move carefully and cautiously. Don't buy into the hype of anything. Be skeptical. Do your own research and see what you find. Everyone should have tried using it, is probably the way I would phrase it. You know, whether you're holding some over the long term as an investment or speculation is really a separate question. I would caution someone that if you're going to invest anything into crypto, assume it'll go to zero. It is super risky, it is super volatile, and it is still very new. Do not assume in any way that it is some surefire way to get rich. But learn about it and use it and understand it. If you feel like owning some, because you think it's an important technology, then do it.
Eric Voorhees, mega thanks for your valuable time. And please let us know when you have more to share. Open invitation, and the mic is always on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Everyone has heard about wage garnishment. Someone doesn't pay their taxes? Wage garnishment. Missed child support? Wage garnishment. Lost a case in small claims court? Wage garnishment. Hopefully all you've ever done is hear about wage garnishment and never actually experienced it. But did you ever hear about a local government essentially having its wages, or rather its tax and revenue stream, garnished by the state? It's happening now, and could be happening a lot more in the near future. Welcome to the unhappy world of underfunded pension plans. In Harvey, Illinois, the police pension fund requested that the state comptroller withhold just over $1 million in monthly revenues due the city in order to pay pension funds for retired municipal workers whose government employers had not allocated enough of their local tax money to workers' retirement benefits. The comptroller did withhold $1.07 million, sparking a legal battle that resulted in a temporary restraining order in which the Illinois comptroller will release the money in question to the city of Harvey. The city stated that while the Illinois Pension Code authorizes the comptroller to embargo such funds at the request of a pension fund, such actions can only take place if a municipality is delinquent and the city of Harvey maintains it is compliant with its obligations. Prior to the temporary restraining order being granted, Harvey did respond by moving to lay off 30 police officers and firefighters. And there are many more municipalities in Illinois that are not far behind, and even more across the country in similar situations. This temporary restraining order is not the end of the problem. It only represents the beginning. The first sign of weakness in paying pension obligations will result in legal wrangles of many sorts. It's a rapidly escalating game of financial hot potato or musical chairs. But it's musical chairs being rearranged on a ship deck that is beginning to sink in its entirety. Regardless of how short-term legal battles develop, the handwriting is clearly on the wall. Pensions are in jeopardy, and everyone will protect their turf. Rightly so, but where does it end? If comptrollers are eventually allowed to garnish municipal revenues, how will those municipalities respond to offset those shortfalls? One option, they will raise property taxes. But it will likely be a distasteful combination of tax increases and cuts in personnel and services. A lengthy article on this subject at wirepoints.com concluded with a reader's comments which stated, "Harvey has no bond market option, no more room to tax option, no constitutional option to reduce their obligation, no ability to outright default option as they are now garnished, no cash flow option, no sellable asset option as the town is a wreck. What's left to do? Bankruptcy. The problem is, who will run that process? According to WirePoint.com, in Illinois, cities cannot, as of yet, reform pensions, cut labor costs, or declare bankruptcy. The state sets the rules that define pension benefits and the collective bargaining laws that must be followed. If Illinois cities are to get out of this impossible situation, that has to change." Regardless of whether you live in Harvey, the state of Illinois, or for that matter, anywhere in the country, the impact of this situation will be coming to a city near you. What are you doing to prepare yourself for the eventuality of these situations? Remember, chance favors the prepared mind. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.